This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, October 8th, 2001, the FBI begins its investigation into a series of letters containing what we would come to learn is anthrax powder that were mailed around the country. This is a story that I've wanted to do on this show for a long time, basically since we launched it. It is also a story that is on my list of things that should be a 10-part Netflix documentary. I don't know why it's not. So I'm glad we're here to discuss it. With me, as always, is Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, hello.
Look, these letters started to appear, obviously, in the wake of the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the fall of 2001. Five Americans ended up being killed and 17 were sickened. And a lot of those were people who sort of handled these letters as they got sent through the Postal Service. This counts as the worst biological attack in U.S. history. It turns into this massive, we'll get into this massive and massively complicated and convoluted investigation. But we should start with the letters themselves. Who is getting them and what exactly is inside these letters?
Sure. So, well, one of the things that's inside the letters is anthrax.
In powder form, right?
In powder form. Yeah. They were sent to the New York Post and NBC News, so to media organizations, and to Senators Daschle and Leahy in Congress. So these were some pretty high profile people and organizations. And, you know, they're the kind of all caps letter you might expect from somebody who's sending you anthrax. The one to the New York Post and NBC News read, "This is next. Take penicillin now. Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great." And then the one to the senators read, "You cannot stop us. We have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great." And so you can imagine how letters like this play in an environment where, you know, 3 weeks or so after the September 11th attacks, tensions are incredibly high.
Yeah. And, you know, I think as you're reading what's on those letters, people are maybe imagining what the writing looks like. And it looks like what you're imagining it looks like, right? All caps, sort of scrawly, some misspelling in there in these letters. I mean, anthrax is no joke. And we should talk about kind of the seriousness of that. But, you know, I think the context that you're describing in which it just was a moment in which it felt like there were threats everywhere. It was really, really important. And, you know, there is a pretty heavy response, no surprise, from the government. There's a huge task force. It would come to have 25, 30 full-time investigators. Over the years, they would interview 10,000 witnesses across the country, 80 searches, recovery of thousands and thousands of items related to this investigation. It does narrow in on one suspect. We'll get to him in a moment. I suppose, is this the moment that we point out that the investigation is closed, but it's not quote unquote solved in any way? I mean, this does sort of remain a mystery, right?
I mean, that's kind of a spoiler for what comes next. But
oh boy,
yes,
sorry.
There is some question as to whether the person who ultimately was deemed responsible for these anthrax letters actually was the only person responsible for these anthrax letters.
So look, listeners, forget that spoiler. Let's go back to the fall of 2001 and imagine this. I mean, no surprise, right? The first thought is, this is Al-Qaeda. This is a terrorist attack. And there are some really fascinating wrinkles in terms of how that plays out. It gets wrapped up into the post-September 11th investigations. And the White House sort of starts to intervene. And lo and behold, a name that people might recognize, FBI director at the time, Robert Mueller, kind of gets wrapped up in this investigation.
Yeah, so Mueller gets pressure from White House officials to blame these attacks on Al-Qaeda following the September 11th attacks. There were some attempts to link it to Saddam Hussein. They would find other false things to link to him later. But remember this period after the September 11th attacks, there were lots of rumors that were swirling around. There was a lot of false information flying around about terror attacks. Everyone was on edge. So a little push like that from Bob Mueller could have very easily escalated what was already an incredibly tense situation. And the U.S. was already about to go to war, if they hadn't already, with Afghanistan. So there was a lot happening, and putting more disinformation into the mix would have been pretty catastrophic.
Right. Though it is interesting. I mean, you know, it's a reminder that I guess Robert Mueller has felt political pressure before, right? And I didn't hear this brought up when he was doing the Russia investigation, this being part of his experience. But certainly that's always the case, I suppose, especially in these heated moments and these politicized moments. You also don't hear this brought up as a sort of example of the way that the Bush White House was really trying to make a case against al-Qaeda and also Saddam Hussein in the wake of 9/11.
Right. That kind of dot connecting isn't necessarily happening in the way that we tell the stories now. I think in part because this story has largely been forgotten. I feel like, you know, you've mentioned this story to me a lot, and I'm like, oh, yeah, anthrax happened. But other than that, I don't think I've thought about this since October 2001. Like, it's never really stuck in my brain.
Yeah. And I mean, this, I will say, you know, continues to befuddle me that we don't sort of remember this. 4 people died. 17 were sickened. There were letters sent, you know, all around the country with anthrax powder in it. It's just not part of our story. I don't know why it's not part of, like, frankly, part of conspiracy theory world. Maybe it is. I don't dabble too much. You probably know better than I do. But yeah, it just seems to have weirdly fallen out of the public imagination or the story we tell of that moment. And maybe it's because so many other things happened in the wake of 9/11 that this kind of, to me, bonkers, mind-blowing, really intense story doesn't even rank.
I think that we just have a shortage of conspiracy theorists. They were too tied up with everything else that was happening, and we didn't have any to catch kind of the smaller stories that were falling through the cracks.
Huh, interesting. So let's talk about our suspect here. There's a man by the name of Bruce Ivins that the investigation sort of starts to hone in on. He worked for almost 20 years at the government's biodefense labs. He was a top biodefense researcher, and he becomes a suspect of interest. But, you know, the interesting thing here is he remains a suspect for years and years and years, right?
Right. This isn't a case that is in any way solved right away. It's 2008 before we get reports that the FBI was closing in. And even then, I think reports since have suggested that the FBI didn't have a clear-cut case. The thing that linked them to Ivins was sort of tracing the genetics of the spores of anthrax to anthrax that Ivins himself was the only person who had in his possession. So there was kind of a scientific trace linking him to these anthrax spores that were put in the letters. The question is, the anthrax that was put into those letters was turned into an inhalable powder. And nobody really thinks that Ivins had the ability to do that. And so that's what raises the question about who all was involved, like who turned this anthrax into its deadly form.
And so, you know, it takes a long time to investigate, to build this case, as you've been saying. It is summer of 2008 that the word starts to come out that they are going to potentially make an arrest or bring charges against Ivins. And then he commits suicide, actually, before he can be arrested, before charges can get brought. And that kind of brings an end to his chapter in this story. And you know, as you've been saying, there's just a kind of unknown here about whether he was capable of this. I don't, in reading about this, get a sense of any sort of sense of motive if it is Ivins. And that's another sort of big black box here, mystery at the heart of this. Is just like, why would he do this, or why would someone do this, period?
I think it's fair that that's an open question. I mean, you can imagine in the chaos after the September 11th attacks that somebody who was interested in doing something like this would take advantage of that chaos. It's just that we don't know enough about Ivins to make sense of why he would be the person who would be engaged in this. Yeah. But there are, at any moment, lots of people with lots of hidden motives all around the world. So, yeah.
But something that you hinted at there is like something I've been thinking about that. And I don't know anything about Ivins's ideology. I don't know anything about his motives or even, you know, whether he was the person, as we've been discussing. But in general, you see that people who have an impulse towards chaos, an impulse towards destruction or doing something like that, they pick up what's in the zeitgeist at a given moment. And so these letters, to me, I will say, you know, strike me as that because they're happening in the fall of 2001, they're going to mention death to Israel. They're going to mention al-Qaeda. They're going to mention these things. And we see it then in other eras, people pick up other things that are in the news. We've even seen it, you know, with Antifa and Black Lives Matter and all the, and sort of these moments where it's not really an ideology. It's more just kind of an expression of chaos that happens to pull strands from whatever is in the zeitgeist at the moment.
Yeah, this is related to studies of radicalism. The way that people are radicalized and the ideas they're radicalized to are often dependent on what they're exposed to. So even if we don't want to say that somebody like Ivins, because we don't know, was radicalized, that same kind of response to the stew of news and horrors and chaos around you is going to shape the way you express your own preference for destruction and those kinds of things. So yeah. I think we see something in common there.
Right. And you know, just to put a fine point on it, sometimes that reads as political ideology because politics is in the news or whatever, but it's not, right? And I think like you sort of look at these trends and know this better than I do, but you know, you look at like Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, who seemed to have firm, you know, ideas about the world and was sort of being destructive with a political ideology behind it. And then, you know, to pull an example from just this summer, you know, you have these reports, which I think are generally BS, but like even these rumors that like leftists are lighting these forest fires in the Northwest. Well, it's like, no, these were people who were going to light a forest fire anyway, and they happen to be pulling in whatever's in the news at the moment or the words of the moment. I just think it's a reminder. Just because something is wrapped in political language doesn't mean that it has a coherent political ideology behind it. So as we wrap up, I mean, we should say that there have been over the years other similar instances like this, and I suppose we can classify them all as hoaxes, but it does sort of, it has become, I guess, a trope or something in the decades since.
Yeah, I mean, if you are somebody who likes to spread fear and chaos, putting a little powdered sugar in a letter will scare people, because anthrax was something that was deadly. It was something that people were very afraid of. And for a pretty low cost, you don't have to go out and find yourself some anthrax. You can put some terror in people's hearts.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll leave it on that note. Thank you, as always, Nicole Hemmer.
Thank you, Jody.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Follow us on social media. We're posting a bunch of stuff on Twitter and Instagram every day, or email us thisdaypod@gmail.com with any questions, comments, suggestions about the show. Thanks to everyone who emailed us and told us that we had misspelled Lloyd Benson's name. That's on me in the show description. It was there for like an hour and then I fixed it, but a bunch of people caught it. Apologies to you and to Lloyd Benson. There is also a contact form at thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.